Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the Center for Faith Studies on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Christian Pyatt, Director of Premium Content for the interfaith website Patheos, and author of Lost, A Search for Meaning, and, with his wife Amy, My Space to Sacred Space, God for a New Generation. He'll speak on the topic, Post-Christian, What's Left? Can We Fix It? Do We Care? This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, September 25th, 2014, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Center for Faith Studies, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Kelly Keller, the director of the Center for Faith Studies.
Tonight, we do have with us Christian Pyatt, and I had this all written up as far as, you know, say this or say that, but I got to spend the last couple of days with Christian, and really, he's just a great all-around guy, and the instincts that I had from reading what I read, I was telling him that some of the speakers that we're bringing now are new to me because I was new to the UCC and had a more Lutheran Catholic background. So some of these theologians and speakers are totally new to me. But I said, but you were not as new to me because when I was searching, I typed in the words progressive Christianity and, whoa, there was this blog that he was part of and he touched on the humor part with these, and I encourage any of you to go to it. It's these epic church sign fails, and where he's just pointing out the times when some churches with their street signs, et cetera, perhaps aren't thinking about the way that message might look or come across. And it really struck a tone with me. But I think what's really important about Christian, where he comes from, is again, where I think all of us are coming from, which is God is love. And the rest of the details are silly to be fighting over. If they're breaking up our relationship, we might want to question those principles if we can't be in relationship with each other across those principles. And I think that's just the most important thing, is that dogged determination to love people and to love each other and to love God within that. And Christian does it with humor and humility and just sincerity that I hope you all will enjoy as much as I have gotten to enjoy over the last couple days. So with that, I just want to bring Christian up. Will you welcome Christian today?
Well, thank you for having me here. I've had a lot of firsts this trip, actually, already. I've never been to Nebraska. In all the travels I've had, this is the first time. It's been great. And I'm pretty sure that I heard Eric say this. I'm not positive, but I'm pretty sure this is what you meant, that I've got a free pass to come back and speak here anytime I want, forever. That's what I heard. Not because of the book, Post-Christian, What's Left? Can We Fix It? Do We Care? That is on sale right now in the lobby. And not because I have some brilliant theological insight, but because, get this, I am the reason that the Darkwood crew won trivia night at Clancy's last night. You're welcome. It was a Fat Albert reference, by the way, if you care. I was pretty proud of myself. So, just out of curiosity, how many of you know the cartoon that the kids from Fat Albert used to run home to watch after school? Oh, do you know? What's that? Ah, see, this is why it was the big question. It was the Brown Hornet. So, yeah, little known trivia. I shook that loose from my brain. Vast receptacle of useless knowledge that it is. So now I'm going to spill that on you for 45 minutes or so. So, Post-Christian, what a strange book title to be coming and talking to you about in, of all places, a church. And as a person named Christian, I understand no small amount of irony in this. My wife says, you should call it After Me. And I said, yeah, well, let's hope this isn't some foreboding about my career then, based on this book. But it is Whether we like it or not, it is the end of Christianity as we know it. Thank you. Good night. No. No. I'm not telling you anything you don't already know. That is not news to anyone who's paying any attention to reality. Christianity's changing. It has been changing. And there are lots of people who have been trying to keep it from changing or try to get it to go back to something they seem to remember it was, right? But this is not going to happen. And I don't mean that to be a wet blanket. But the fact is, we don't want to go back to what was. And the fact is that Christianity will never be the same again is actually a beautiful and wonderful, and I would say divinely inspired opportunity and not a catastrophe. So that is where the book comes from. It is making the case for that. So to start out, I want to read you a little bit from the book. And I realized I started marking all the bits that I wanted to read to you. And I thought, so I'm speaking for 3 hours, right? Yeah. I was like, there's no way I'm going to make it through all this. So I had my quad espresso, and I thought, I'll just speak really fast. No, we'll skip around probably, but I'm going to do my best to cover as much of this as I can. So the book starts out, says, this book will piss you off. At least a little bit. It should, at least. The Christian religion is not what it should be, what it claims to be. And whether you're a religious insider, a battered and bruised outcast, or a curious bystander, that should bother you. It bothers me. But for every wound I expose, for every wrong I call out from the darkness into light, it's my hope that you'll find an equal measure of hope, love, and inspiration in the pages to come. There will be times when you want to set this book down for a while, or even throw it against the wall. And that's fine. Just don't walk away from it. See, that's the problem. We find it all too easy to walk away when things get screwed up, when they let us down, when the divisions seem unbridgeable, but we owe it to one another to stick it out, if we truly are a family, after all, to see more than one side of the story and to try as hard as it may be to see through someone else's eyes. I'm not trying to get you to go back to church. Actually, surprise, you're in church. But if you're already in church, I'm not trying to get you to stay any more than I'm trying to get you to leave. I don't care if you call yourself a Christian or not. I don't care if you've been baptized, offered the sinner's prayer, or proclaimed before a group of fellow believers that you've accepted Jesus into your heart. I care more about the lives we are choosing to live as individuals, members of society, as churchgoers, skeptics, seekers, doubters, than I do about what you claim to believe, or the institutions or groups with which you identify. The labels do not matter. You matter. For me, trying to model my life, my words, and my ideas after a man I believe walked the earth about 2,000 years ago is a personal choice, but it is one of many, many possible choices. I don't need you to think like me, to believe the things I believe, for us more closely to resemble what I think we've been created to be. So call yourself a Christian or don't. Go to church or don't, but come to this book with open eyes, an open heart, and a willing mind. I trust, as I hope you trust, that the rest will take care of itself. That's a lot to ask, I understand. But I do trust that the rest will take care of itself. So when I say that it's the end of Christianity as we know it, and that actually that's a good thing, what I mean is, really what we're witnessing right now is the end of Christendom. And that's a really fancy word for Christian hegemony, which is another fancy word, which basically means that we've been the big kid on the block for a long, long time. We've been making the rules. We've been guiding and basically dictating the conversation for a long time, so long, in fact, that we've decided that it's normal. And the fact is that what we have done is, even with the best of intentions, we have marginalized and silenced other voices through our hegemony. And that is not Christ-like. So, whatever helps loosen our grip on that hegemonic rule and dominance that we have had in the culture, I believe gives us an opportunity to get that much closer to the gospel. So, we first need to, I want to do a really brief history lesson here of where this came from. Because the fact is, Christian empire didn't just spring up once the United States was established. This started a long way back. How many of you are familiar with Constantine, the Council of Nicaea? Okay. See, I did a talk in Oregon a few days ago, and I asked that question, and I swear I heard the mouth breathing was just all I got. The crickets and the mouth breathing was it. I was like, wow, okay, this is going to be a longer section than I anticipated. So it was a marriage of convenience, if you will, between church and state, right? It actually helped support the agenda of the church to spread its message across the world in ways that it could not on its own. And it also created a state religion for Constantine, who really didn't, as far as I can tell, really care that much about Christianity, personally, honestly. It was a political move for him. So that was one thing. It set the wheels of Christian empire into motion because it spread all over the world at that point, for better or worse. And we know some of the stories of how that happened, right? We know about the Inquisition. We know about the Crusades. Eight Crusades? Nine Crusades. A lot of Crusades happened. And a lot of people died in the name of Jesus. In fact, there are still places, I find it interesting. I have family that lives in New Mexico, and they have these things called petroglyphs, which are etchings that are done on stones there. And there are crosses there. But actually, I was corrected by someone, and they said, actually, those are the conquistadores' swords. And they actually conflated swords with the cross. They didn't see the difference. They thought that this was a giant sword, because that's what they saw coming at them when the conquistadores came to share the love of Jesus with them. I can understand the mistake, an honest mistake, right? So there was that. That happened. And then we had the Enlightenment. And a lot of amazing things came out of the Enlightenment. For better or worse, they're amazing things. The stock market came out of the Enlightenment. Like I said, for better or worse, a lot of incredible things came out of it. But one of the things that came out of the Enlightenment was post-Enlightenment liberal thought. Now, that sounds really nice, doesn't it? And especially in a UCC church, you know, liberal thought. That sounds great. Freedom of thought. Everybody thinks for themselves. Well, that's not exactly what it meant. What it meant was that we could actually rationalize everything, including the existence of God, the creeds of the church, and everything else. Everything could be rationally argued. And so there was a right answer and there was a wrong answer. And when you have right and wrong that are delineated that clearly, there's always going to be somebody on the wrong side. Okay? Third, you have the frontier mentality in the United States. You guys are probably familiar with the phrase manifest destiny. This, combined with the idea of dominionism, that we have lordship over the entire earth, and that the most important thing is to spread our culture, our influence, our beliefs to all corners of that world, means that it is more important than the very lives that might be lost in the process. Okay, so it spreads west, and I think this is fascinating because I actually serve in a frontier church in Oregon. It's actually older than the state of Washington, which I think is fascinating. I can only imagine the climate in which that was established. So you've got this religious zeal combined with the frontier mentality and exuberance of manifest destiny, combined with this idea of normalized post-Enlightenment liberal thought, which says, I can argue the existence of God and the reason that my faith is superior to yours, combined with the existence of Christian empire that existed for centuries, and we have a toxic combination that happened here, okay? And the fact is that what we saw in the early part of the 20th century was the explosive growth of church, right? Especially as people came back from World War II. And one of the things that we mistakenly did was we misunderstood the fact that numeric growth means that God is on our side. And that maybe circumstances were more in our favor, and then it didn't necessarily have to do with God's will as much as the convergence of these circumstances coming together in a way that could not have happened any other way. So But then what happened? Well, a few things happened. First, the church is no longer the social and economic hub of the community that it used to be. How many of you live within 20 blocks of this church? Okay, right? How many of you live more than 5 miles from this church? Yeah. So that's very common, right? And the fact is that we don't just go to our community church. We don't just go to our community store. We don't just have our little community neighborhoods that are self-contained like they used to be. We are a diaspora. We have spread out. You can blame the interstate system if you want. You can blame the automobile if you want. You can blame our desire for radical self-reliance if you want. But the fact is we've done it. We're spread out. And we don't require the social epicenter of the church to hold us together anymore. And that's where a lot of the economic deals used to go down, too. I'm not saying like the church was getting a kickback, but, you know, Frank sits next to Ted, and then they make a deal right before worship, and it's networking, man. But now you've got LinkedIn and Facebook and all these other things that can do that for you, right? We don't need to come to church for that reason. The other thing is that the social stigma of not going to church or even not being a Christian has significantly reduced in our culture. It used to be that you could not suggest that you weren't a church-going person and still expect to have good standing in the culture, right? And so my argument is, it's not so much that we have fewer Christians, we just have fewer butts in the pews. There were plenty of non-Christians in church back in the day, okay? And I know a lot of them. A lot of them are in my family. The fact is now they just don't go anymore. It's not that they were ever listening or agreed with it to begin with. Wheat and chaff, I don't know. Cognitive dissonance, force them into the pews until, you know, fake it till you make it kind of stuff. Well, it didn't work for them. I don't know. For some, I'm sure it did. So there were a lot of things that happened. Another is the advent of the democratization of information. That's a big fancy concept. It was actually in Time Magazine's Answers issue. I don't know if you guys, but I am addicted to infographics, man. I love those things. It's like informational crack for a blogger. We just love that stuff. So basically what it said was, it used to be the stories about Lincoln and how far he walked to get a book, right? How far do you have to go to find out the airspeed velocity of a swallow now? Or the recipe for ginger lavender cookies, or the dates when the Nicene Creed was established. You could do it from right here and pretend like you're still listening to me, right? That is called the democratization of information. And what that does is it devalues or threatens the sovereignty or the integrity of so-called gatekeepers. You see things like libraries starting to struggle. And I'm not saying like libraries are gatekeepers as if, you know, they kick people out and they decide who's worthy to read or whatever. But the fact is you don't have to go to these places that hold the information anymore to get it. It's just out there in the cloud, right? And so this has continued to happen more and more in our culture. And it actually reduces the role of gatekeepers. And the problem is that churches for too long have benefited from being gatekeepers rather than being humble servants and stewards, because it served us well. Okay? It served us well to be gatekeepers because it gave us power. And I'm not saying you did it. But if you look all the way back through the history of the Catholic Church and even after the Reformation, we did this. We decided who could and couldn't take communion. We decided whose sins could and couldn't be absolved. We decided who could hold land and who couldn't. We decided who could do what with their naughty bits and who couldn't. I mean, we've done this over and over. We're still doing it. I talked to somebody today. We were just talking today about a young woman who got kicked out of a college near here because of her sexual orientation. There are still gatekeepers in our midst, but they have less and less of a grip on our culture. Okay? So, the church that wants to be relevant needs to understand the difference between servant and steward and gatekeeper. And when they're incidentally even behaving as a gatekeeper, even if they don't mean to. There are a lot of other reasons, but those are some of the reasons. And some of them are because of things that we have done to ourselves. And the fact is also, we should mention in the history bit, how many of you have ever heard of proto-orthodoxy? Yeah, it's a weird thing. Yeah, okay, the nerd up in front did. But yeah, you don't get extra points for that, you know. I hadn't actually even heard about it until I did research for this book. It turns out, did you know that some of the early Christians, before proto-orthodoxy took hold, were polytheists? They believed there were two gods. Some believed there were three gods. Some Christians believed there were 365 gods. Some believed in the sacrament of baptism and communion, and some did not. Some believed in transubstantiation, that the bread and the wine actually become blood and flesh, and some did not. There were those who believed in the Trinity and those who did not. There were those who believed in the divinity of Jesus and those who didn't. There's those who believed in the literal interpretation of scriptures and those who didn't. This is like 300 AD, we're talking. And all of that got squashed when proto-orthodoxy came along and said, no, 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 no. We can't have this. This is way too messy. You guys are thinking way too much for yourselves. And we can't have a church state with all this independent thinking going on. So here's how it's going to be. You are saved by immersive baptism or, you know, what have you. You take communion and you're blessed by a priest to be absolved by your sins, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. There is only one God and so forth. And so all the others were deemed as heresies and apostasies, and they were grounds for execution. That was it. And unfortunately, we have fallen into that sort of mindset, and I don't mean, I know in some, to some degree, I'm preaching to the choir here, okay? I don't want you to feel like I'm sitting here like this is an hour-long scolding session, like, this is what you're doing wrong. I'm just speaking more of a historical sense about Christianity, right? That we have tended to do that. We have had you've heard the phrase culture wars. Any of you who lived through the 80s have heard the phrase culture wars, I'm sure. It is the fact that we are facing an enemy, and that enemy is secularism. And the secular world has two choices: assimilate or be cast into outer darkness. That is the exact same mentality that came from proto-orthodoxy some 1600 years ago. Assimilate or be extinguished. So we kind of set ourselves up there, I think, when people kind of called our bluff on that and said, I don't think I need you to access God anymore. And all of a sudden we're saying, whoa, whoa, wait, 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 wait. But it has been on an inevitable path to this for centuries, since the Gutenberg Bible, even. All of a sudden, information was democratized. It was spreading around. And then all of a sudden, they didn't necessarily need someone to read the Bible for them in mass. They could read it for themselves. So, but we have also made the mistake of misrepresenting God to some degree. And again, Christianity with a big C. We the church, have misrepresented God and what Jesus calls us to be in the world. We have succumbed to the misapprehension that Christianity is primarily about what we believe. I'm going to read that again because it's important. And I know it may feel a little uncomfortable, and that's okay. We have succumbed to the misapprehension that Christianity is primarily about what we believe. We have been experts in identifying people's longings, needs, brokenness, desires, and pain, but we have offered a false antidote. We have claimed that inviting Jesus as Lord and Savior into our hearts has an enduring salvific effect that helps make the suffering and the longing go away. We have made the case that individual salvation is central to our faith and that we can enjoy the fullness of God's presence by participating in the life as prescribed by us, the church. The problem is that this is not what Jesus asked us to do. Our commoditization or even monetization of God as the solution to all of life's problems has caused us to be seen as peddlers of a snake oil cure whose lack of efficacy has been found out. The God we've sold from the pulpit, in Sunday school classes, on television, radio, and now online is a false idol. And Christians purveying this blasphemously ungodlike God are among the last to realize they are worshiping a golden calf. I know this sounds heretical, and I will unpack this further in the book, if you read it. But suffice it to say for now that Jesus' ministry to the world was about so very much more than feeling good. Whether in the context of worship and daily life or in contemplating the fate of our immortal souls, Christianity has for too long promoted the false god of personal prosperity and happiness, while ignoring the reality that our lifestyles, the lifestyles we as Christians live here in the United States, are built on the backs and shoulders of those without power. So that's a sobering reality we have to come to terms with. To say that we are blessed with all of this and not to acknowledge the systems of oppression that have led to us being able to live like this and then calling it God's blessing, we got to be really, really careful, I think, with that. So some secularists actually celebrate the decline of organized religion. Christopher Hitchens and the like, you know, they're all out there, or Penn Jillette or whoever is out there today, you know, dancing on the grave preemptively of Christianity. And then there are those Christians who see it as a call to arms. It is, we have to double down. We've got to fight harder than ever before to make sure that our faith is secure in the culture. But the fact is, I believe that actually both are out of line. The scripture talks about that the vision for God's kingdom on earth is when the lion and the lamb can lay down together. But the problem is that everybody thinks that they're the lamb, and that whatever is frightening or threatening to them is the lion. No one wants to see themselves as the lion preying on the lamb. But we can't all be lambs in the story. Maybe you're a little bit lamb and a little bit lion, you know. But we have to come to terms with the fact that we've done our own share of damage along the way. I think it's also important, because I have read plenty of books, I imagine you have too, about how the gospel calls us to, the good news is when every ear is heard, every tongue is confessed, everybody is just like us, the world has come to their senses and become one big, happy Christian world, and we're all singing the same tune. Then Jesus will come back, do a 360 alley-oop, slam dunk, you know, in his Jordans, and give us a high five for doing a good job, right? Now, that would be nice, but the fact is that the way I understand it is that is a gospel of victory. We want to see that we win. But the gospel is actually one not of victory, but of liberation. And there's a really important difference, okay? Now, I have heard, like, you set a table before my enemies. I actually went to a funeral one time where the guy said, yeah, that's going to be awesome because you're going to have this big plate with pizza and spare ribs and all this great stuff, and all your enemies are going to be groveling at your feet for crumbs, and you're going to be like, get out of here, yeah, because that's what setting a table before their enemies was to him. And to me, what it means is you are going to have to do the hard work of being face-to-face with your enemy over a meal. Nowhere to go. Can't skip the tab. Can't excuse yourself to the restroom. You know, this is face-to-face. It's reconciliation work, but it's liberation work. So a conqueror obliterates or oppresses the enemy. A liberator removes the enemy's power over his victim. With this result, both oppressor and oppressed have to then find a way to coexist, living side by side in a world where they can no longer be content to label their enemy as the other. This difference is crucial in our discussion of a post-Christian world, because there's potential for greater division between those we seek to preserve, who seek to preserve the historical church as it has been, and those who seek to remove religion from the cultural discussion altogether. The prophet Isaiah speaks of God's vision for humanity as one in which the lion lies down with the lamb. The lambs might feel it would be fair to turn the tables and have a go at the lions for once. That's fair, but that's not God's kind of fair. And we can look at the prodigal son, the vineyard workers. You know, there are all kinds of stories about God's justice being unfair in our understanding of the term. In contemporary culture, where secularists cheer the decline of the church and Christians hold fast to their convictions in a perceived culture war, we both see the other as lions preying on their identity, seeking to destroy something they hold dear. But if the lamb is liberated from the fear of being destroyed by the lion, the two must now engage in the hard work of learning how to live together. It no longer matters who is viewed as predator and who as prey. But it's not fair, we say. We wanted justice, and all we got was peace. No wonder we killed Jesus. Would it be any different if he came back today? I wonder. One of the things that we have to do is start approaching our Bibles differently. We have to haul them out and put our cell phones in them. And no, that was just Eric. Okay. Yeah. I'm coveting his cell phone cover, by the way. That is pretty awesome. How many of you have read the book On the Road by Jack Kerouac? More of you need to read On the Road by Jack Kerouac. It's an amazing book. But I hated it, to be honest with you. I know, that sounds weird, right? Hey, it's postmodernism, man. We live in paradox. Just go with it. No. I hated it because I didn't understand the point. Okay, so basically the story is about Kerouac and Ginsberg and these guys going across the country in this big car and stopping along the way, popping Benzedrines, drinking a lot, going too fast, staying out too late, listening to jazz, getting to the other side of the country, running out of money, and finally figuring out how to get back to the other side. And then they get all the way back home, and what do? Turn around and do it all over again. And I got to the end, I was like, damn it, nothing happens in this book. But the problem wasn't the book, the problem was me. Because I wanted it to read like Die Hard. I wanted there to be a problem, conflict, resolution. I wanted there to be a good guy. I wanted there to be a bad guy. Usually the good guy wins. Maybe every once in a while the bad guy seems like he's going to win, but eventually the good guy wins. I was stuck in this linear understanding of storytelling. And I was applying that to On the Road because plenty of things happened in the book. A lot of things happened in the book, but it didn't have a beginning, middle, end like I expected it to. And how often do we approach the Bible like that? In the beginning, and then Revelation, the end, and the stuff, some stuff in the middle, some gospel, some letters, some things like that, and that Old Testament bloody, gory, gross stuff that we'll just kind of pretend like it's not really part of our story. And we get to the end, and love wins, God wins, yay, God, we win, we get to be, you know, all together and shiny, happy people, and scene, curtain drops, and it's all good. But the problem is, that's not how to approach the Bible. If we approach the Bible more like we approach On the Road, what I had to do was I had to just let it wash over me. I had to let go of these expectations of a linear story that was going to go from this to this to this to this, and it was all going to end up clean and neat and tied up with a bow, and the good guys were going to win, and the bad guys were going to get their asses kicked just like they should. But it doesn't work that way. It didn't work that way for Jesus. And that's what the Israelites wanted from him. They wanted this Jesus to come in to kick butt and to take over and to claim a new kingdom on earth, literally, right? But the fact is, Walter Winks says, if you do that, all you do is you change the rulers, but you never change the rules. You perpetuate the cycle of oppression, of empire, of violence, and you never change anything because all you're doing is passing the baton from one person to another. And Jesus saw that, and he said, enough! You owe yourself more than this. You owe your neighbors, your brothers and sisters more than this. You should want more than this. But we couldn't see past it. And when we take that lens to the Bible, we make it say whatever we need it to say to support that existing worldview. So we have to deconstruct some of that. And I know if any of you have done any reading in postmodern theology, Peter Rollins, John Caputo, any of these guys who are doing a lot of theological deconstruction, it can be a little scary, it can be a little exhausting. Because it seems like they're taking everything that I've presupposed about God, about faith, about the Bible and everything, and kind of dismantling it and leaving all the Legos on the floor. But the fact is, if a kid dismantles the pieces of a Lego set, that doesn't mean that it's finished. It just means that it doesn't look the way you thought it was going to look. You can still build something entirely different out of it. The pieces are still there. But once you look at the picture and you decide that's the only thing Christianity can be, is that picture on the box, then anybody who gets in the way of those pieces looking like that is the enemy. They are the other. Instead of saying, hey, what do you think this should look like? Here, have some Legos. Don't step on them because they will permanently scar your feet forever and ever. I say that as a parent of two children. But spread the Legos around. Don't worry so much about what it's going to look like at the end and get more engaged in the process of engaging others who don't see the world like you, who don't see God like you. And as we become less threatened by that and more enriched by that experience, we become awakened to a richer, more nuanced, and more full understanding of the nature of God, I believe. And the thing is, that can happen in church, but it doesn't have to. Jesus said, wherever two or more are gathered. In the book, I talk about I had 15 things marked in here, and I've like 8 minutes from being done, and I've read you two. This is usually how my talks go. So I'm going to read 13 to you right in a row. No. In the book, the way I frame my conversation about this is that some of these things we have brought on ourselves. And I call those the seven scandals of Christianity. And I basically, I roughly base those on the seven deadly sins. So you have, for example, the Christian scandal of judgment. I think we're all familiar with that. We've seen it. We've experienced it. We've been victims of it before. Hopefully not perpetrators of it. Although, we all have an other whom we judge. Whether it's those Christians who judge, or our neighbor whose stupid dog won't be quiet, or whoever. We find someone and we judge them, right? We all do that. It's in our nature. There is the Christian scandal of lust, greed, fear. There are a lot of them. But one of them that I find most interesting is certainty. The Christian scandal of certainty. We don't talk about the danger of certainty very much. But when I talked about post-Enlightenment liberal thought, one of the things about that is, if there is a right and wrong answer, you can be certain, you can have the blessed assurance, so to speak, that you are right. And the thing is that our brains actually seek out these predictable patterns in life. Otherwise, my wife would not stay up until 3 a.m. playing Candy Crush. Or I would not have almost failed out of college sitting around playing Minesweeper. The fact is that we crave repetitive, predictable patterns. They can be as simple as taking a step forward and having the ground be exactly where you think it is. Now, you don't get some big big cognitive reward for that, but the fact is if you do that and then the step is not where you think it is, you know how that feels, right? But the fact is that when your brain anticipates how things are going to happen and then they happen that way, you get a flood of dopamines and endorphins in your brain that feel really, really good. Your brain loves it. And so what it does is say, I want more of that. And so it starts ingraining these patterns of predicting and fulfilling the predictions, even to the point that what we will do is we'll make these predictions, and then anything that comes along that would actually dispel the prediction, like would challenge the prediction, we push to the side and make sure that our patterns of behavior continue to fall in those predictable directions, because it rewards our brain. And literally, physiologists have figured out that we get physiologically addicted to certainty. And I think that's one of the big struggles that we have in church. The problem is, when you have that, then you have to draw a line, right? There has to be a line between right and wrong, between sheep and goats, between insider and outsider. But the thing is, so far, I don't know about you all, but I have not met someone on the outside of the circle who has drawn the line with themselves outside of it. The circle is always around you, right? If you're drawing it, you're going to include yourself in it, unless you're a sociopath. And so the fact is that you put yourself on the inside of that circle. And so I feel like I'm being watched. Come on in. So the problem is that creates an us-them dichotomy, right? It creates an imbalance of power, because we have established the rule of which we are certain where right and wrong is, and who is right and who is wrong. And then someone has to be the one to determine whether or not you get it or not. And that's where the gatekeeper mentality comes from. And that's where I am a real big fan of Alexander Campbell. I think we share this in common in our history, right? Alexander Campbell, he's one of the founders of the Christian Church Disciples of Christ. One of the stories about him was that they used to, when he used to go to church, they would actually issue tokens for communion. If you didn't have a token, you couldn't take communion. And you got the tokens from the priests. The priest decided if you were fit to take communion. So what Campbell did was he took his token, and when he went up to take communion, instead of accepting communion, he set the token down and he walked out of the church. And he started what would become the Stone Campbell movement. So he believed that when, at the moment of Jesus' crucifixion, when the veil was torn, that actually symbolized the destruction of the separation between humanity and God. That we were meant to be able to access God directly through Christ without a gatekeeper. And yet, we have put ourselves over and over again in that role if we're not careful. Whether someone is dressed appropriately, behaves appropriately, thinks appropriately, wants to change our church, doesn't have enough money, has too much money, isn't of the right political party, whatever. We have those gates that we pass through, or that we set up for others to pass through. So we have to be really careful about this, and that is one of the wonderful things about postmodern thought, is the humility that comes from saying, I don't know. I don't know. And that doesn't necessarily mean that that's the end of the conversation. As a pastor I had back in the day told me, he says, I don't know, but I believe, ... We cannot know about the existence of God any more than we can know about the non-existence of God. We cannot know what is a sin for one person or another. We might have a better sense of that for ourselves, right? But if we would approach our faith with some of that humility and the freedom that comes with giving yourself permission not to know, then some amazing conversations start to generate from there. There are lots of others in here, and I do counteract every one of the scandals with a Christ-like virtue. So don't feel like it's all browbeating kind of doom and gloom stuff. It's entirely balanced with Christ-like virtue. So the goal is to encourage you to be less Christian and more Christ-like. And when I say that, I'm referring to how the world understands Christianity. We did a book with my wife some years ago called MySpace to Sacred Space. You can tell how long ago that was written. If we're going to do it now, it'd probably be Facebook to the Good Book or something like that. But But by the time we got that outed, Facebook would be gone. So, but we asked like over 700 people what their thoughts were about God. And we asked agnostics, we asked Jews, we asked pagans, we asked Christians, we asked all kinds, evangelicals, progressives, everybody, their thoughts about God and their thoughts about Jesus. And the words that they came up with that they chose over and over again for God and for Jesus were universally positive, all-loving, compassionate, forgiving, gracious. And then we asked, Christians are, ... 78%. Keep in mind, more than half of the people responding were Christians. But 78% said judgmental. 71% said hypocrites. We let them choose more than one. I know the math doesn't add up. But the fact is, just like Gandhi said, I love Jesus. I don't love your Christians. Your Christians are so unlike your Jesus. And I'm paraphrasing. So I want us to worry less about being good Christians. And I want us to be desperately passionate, breathlessly passionate about the pursuit of being more Christ-like. It doesn't matter what your church says that looks like as much as it does what your heart tells you when you engage Christ through the gospel, through study, through prayer, possibly through worship, but it should not be done necessarily in isolation. And that's the good news for community, is that we have always longed to belong. And the fact is, you can look, there are all these apps now that are popping up to spontaneously let people meet up that they've never met before. They'll meet for meals. They'll meet to go on trips together. They'll meet to go do some event, go to the zoo or whatever. Just people they've never met. They're like, hey, we're all going to the zoo at this time. Who wants to go? Because we are longing for connection. We're so desperate for it. And we've got it right here. The other thing is, we want people to bear witness to our lives. We want to have someone bear witness to our lives and to bear witness to one another's lives. And we do that through the marking of time, through ritual. And we have unfortunately turned a lot of those rituals into gatekeeping tools to decide who's worthy and who is not. But the fact is, they are marking time. They are making sacred little touchstones in our lives as we go along for us to mark the story that we're creating in our lives, individually and collectively. We want to get in touch with the sacred. We want something that helps us feel a connection to something bigger than ourselves. And these are all things, and we also need people to hold us accountable when we screw up. The fact is, I don't know about you, but most of my sinning is not the big obvious stuff that, like, you see, I don't know, Mark Driscoll doing, you know, where it's so obvious and it's on the headlines, splattered all over the place for everybody to see. Sorry, mine are a lot more subtle. They're little justifications, little tiny things that I can say, oh, the means justifies the end, or I'm just not really going to pay attention to where this shirt was sourced from, or really acknowledge the fact that I'm driving myself around in this car that's filled with gas that comes from a village, you know, whose oil was taken from them with, you know, shed blood, you know, things like that. We don't want to know, so we just push it to the side because we don't want things to change. And so we do need to hold each other accountable for that kind of stuff, but also to multiply our joys. Have you ever heard the joke about the guy who was a pastor, and it was a beautiful day. It was a Sunday, but he was an avid golfer, and he went outside. It was so beautiful. He called in sick, made his associate pastor preach for him. So he goes out, and he thinks, oh, man, God is going to get me for this one, right? And so he takes his first swing, par 4, hole in 1. He's like, holy crap. Goes to hole 2, hits it again, hole in 1. 18 holes in a row, 18 strokes. The guy has the perfect game of golf, right? And then he gets back. He is so excited. He's like, wow, God is so good. I have been blessed. I must have been due a Sabbath. And then it occurred to him, he couldn't tell anyone. What does it matter when wonderful things happen to us if no one is there to bear witness, to celebrate with us, to acknowledge that what we do matters, that we matter. Just us, not just what we do. We need those things, and those are things that we have that the world needs. A space in which to experience the sacred, mutual accountability, sharing our burdens, multiplying our joys, belonging. But that takes a servant mentality, not a gatekeeper mentality. And so we have to get our priorities back in order. And the fact is that we also need to keep in mind that being Christ-like doesn't necessarily require a church to have its budget balanced or a certain number of butts in the pews for it to happen. Jesus just went out and did it. He walked around, he noticed needs, and he responded in love. And then he told them to go and do likewise. If your church, if your community of faith, if your spiritual partner is doing that, then Godspeed. If what you're focusing on is keeping the church doors open so someday we can really do the work of God, then God help you. Because Jesus, when you ask him what is required of you, he says, everything. Drop it all. And go. Thank you.
Just raise your hand. We'll bring the mic to you.
Would you do a little futuristic thinking? What do you think the church of the future will look like?
Yes. More churches will close. More denominations will shrink and even combine. Maybe Disciples in UCC will become one after all. Who knows? Imagine that. There will be more intentional communities, meaning people who decide to cohabitate and share all they have. It's happening more and more. It's almost a neo-monastic kind of model. If you're familiar with Shane Claiborne in The Simple Way, moving into a neighborhood to be changed by it as much as you change it, and to bring all that you have, all that you are, your story, and then to be formed by its story, the community's story. Blurring the lines between the secular and the sacred, I think those are the kinds of things that we'll see. The fact is, in a lot of ways, I think it's going back to the roots of the original church, of where we started, when we had nothing, pre-empire, when there was so much to lose in being a Christian that you'd stake your life on it. And so that's what some people are doing. They're putting everything aside and they're throwing it, they're betting it all, you know, on the gospel. I think you'll see people really deeply, richly trying to live that out and modeling that, and that people will be drawn to that. I think you'll see more of a faith of attraction rather than promotion. I think if you want to look at a model that shows us how this can be done without budgets, without buildings, without governance boards and bylaws and all that, I know I'm speaking administrative heresy right now, but the fact is that 12-step groups have been doing this for years and years and years, and they are flourishing while we are floundering. And they're doing it with no money. And they're doing it with no presidents and no chair people and no deacons and no elders. And I'm not saying those are not important things, but it can be done. Movements can thrive without those things. And I think because the gospel is so much bigger, faith is so much bigger than religion, thank God, that it will find its way. The still small voice will continue to persist in our midst. And as long as we're heeding that call, I think we will find new ways to live that out and to share it.
One of your list of seven was fear.
Yes.
I'd like you to talk about that in the context of Christian America in the world today.
Yes. It's the problem with fear is it's really, really effective in the short term. And churches figured that out, that they could mobilize people, they could unify people around fear, they could create a common enemy and galvanize people against something else out of fear. Jonathan Edwards, a famous preacher, hellfire and brimstone, the hellfire and brimstone preacher, you know, he had this famous sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. My father-in-law actually identifies with that, and I know a lot of people who still do, that the reason they are Christian is because they don't want to go to hell, right? And that the reason that we are doing all this is for some celestial reward, which is some interesting admixture of fear and greed, if you ask me. It's Christian narcissism, you know, to assume that you can get all this for a reward later. It's like the biggest deferred compensation Ponzi scheme in the history of the universe. So it's this whole perceived punishment-reward cycle that makes us no more than rats in a Skinner box, really. And I tend to think of God as more than that, and us as more than that, and that there is something more compelling about being Christ-like than the fear of consequence of not. And if it's really something to stake your entire life on, it has to be out of something more compelling than fear. And the thing is, it attaches to that lizard brain part of us. It changes the chemistry in our brains. And so, and it's not as if the mainline church is absent of that. Our fear is not necessarily the fires of hell. Our fear is of irrelevance, of people stopping paying attention to us or not taking us seriously, I think. And when we are fighting against that, when we are operating from that fear rather than from a place of true discernment of what God is calling us to be, then the message we have to share and our motivations become compromised. So it's not that we never talk about fear, but we also put it out into the light of day so it loses its power. When you're scared of something, you know, we've told ourselves we're never to be afraid. It's funny because we use fear in church, but then people aren't supposed to actually act afraid. And so I think part of what we have to do is learn to be transparent. I talk about the Christ-like virtue of courage. Have you all heard of Brené Brown, her TED Talks on vulnerability? She says that we've come to the misapprehension in our culture that vulnerability is actually weakness, but vulnerability is actually strength, and it takes courage, tremendous strength, to say, I'm scared S-less right now, you know, and that takes incredible strength. And so we have to get over this idea that being vulnerable is weak, because what we're doing is we're allowing our fear of vulnerability to dictate our identities. So it's as quick as I can make an answer to that one.
I just really want to thank you for being here. Please give a round of applause. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the Center for Faith Studies on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Christian Pyatt, Director of Premium Content for the interfaith website Patheos, and author of Lost, A Search for Meaning, and with his wife Amy, My Space to Sacred Space, God for a New Generation. He spoke on the topic, Post-Christian, What's Left? Can We Fix It? Do We Care? This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, September 25th, 2014, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Kelly Keller, Director of the Center for Faith Studies, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 400 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Coate, thanking you for listening.